Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, we hear the story of Little White and Little Grey, two beluga whales that have been moved from a watery theme park in China to a seawater sanctuary in Iceland. Terry Flanagan introduces us to PAW, P-A-W, an umbrella organisation set up to fight wildlife crime here in Ireland. And Aine Nealana talks to science journalist Wendy Williams about her new book, The Language of Butterflies.
Yes, Maria Sibylla Marion is one of my favourite characters in the book. She was born in the midst of the 1600s when women were still being burned as witches. So it was the world was a dangerous place for women in those days, and women didn't have very much freedom. They really weren't allowed to do very many things. So mostly when she wasn't helping her dad out working in his publishing house, she was allowed to do things like go out into her mother's garden. She'd heard people talking about insects because insects were very popular in those days, and she started looking at the insects on the plants in her mother's garden, and she began to discover that caterpillars were much more interesting than anyone had ever realized. She also noticed that the caterpillars used the same leaves all the time, and then she learned that they made specific chrysalises, and then she learned that out of these chrysalises emerged specific butterflies.
So, a very busy program ahead of us today. You can send a text message right now about anything at all to 51551 or email Mooney at rte.ie. Don't forget the website is there for you to peruse at any time you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Oh, far too much information. Now, each year at the end of August, hundreds of local communities throughout the country take part in National Heritage Week, which this year runs from the 15th, yesterday, to next Sunday, 23rd of August. The theme for this year's week-long celebration is Heritage and Education, Learning from Our Heritage. And that's exactly what our very own Aine Nealana was doing earlier along the banks of the River Barrow, from where she sent this report.
Yes, Derek, I'm here on the banks of the River Barrow, and I'm walking the walk, as well as talking the talk. There's cast of thousands here. Shout, all you cast of thousands.
Yay!
Well, there's not thousands on account of social distancing, but there's a fair few of us that are well able to talk anyway. All good Kilkenny people, I would imagine. We're here along the Barrow, and I'm talking to Anne Phelan.
Yes.
Tell us who you are and why you organised this.
Well, as we said earlier, I'm Anne Phelan. I work with the local authorities, Waters and Communities Office. That is a shared service set up between Tipperary and Kilkenny local authorities to raise awareness about our rivers, our lakes and our streams, wetlands as well, to try to increase people's awareness of good water quality. And we know that good water quality is really important for our health and our well-being, and of course for biodiversity. And our rivers are biodiversity corridors, so that's why they're so important. And we're delighted to have you, Aine, here with us again on the River Barrow on our wildlife safari.
Yeah, the Barrow is a wonderful river for having a walk along, because there's a lovely towpath, very nice one, along by the edge that we can walk and look into the river on the one hand, and on the other side we have lovely woodland that we're going to be looking at as well in a moment. So I have lots of people here who are really interested. They've come out. We could have a warmer day, but then they'll probably be doing something else. So it's great to have so many people here, and we've been seeing lots of different things. We've been seeing duck. We've been seeing the invasive species. What did I call that one?
The balsam, Himalayan balsam.
Himalayan balsam. We've been seeing different forms of reeds. We've been seeing people jumping into the river and swimming over there. But it's a lovely, lovely place to walk, and we are going to walk quite a way up along the river. Hopefully, if I don't talk too much, can you imagine, we might actually see maybe some river birds, which would be more shy when a whole horde of people are coming along. But we might expect to see something like maybe a kingfisher if we were lucky, because it's a really deep river. We might expect to see something like a heron, which would be great. And of course, if there was very quiet water altogether, we might see fish jumping. So we're really enjoying our walk along the Barrow. So that's the end of the plug now. So back to work. We're standing here underneath a ash tree, and I want you to come over and have a look at the ash tree.
So there's Aina and the gang out learning from our heritage. A lot of events, obviously, hit by COVID this year. Niall Hatch from Birdwatch Ireland is in studio with me today. Niall, have you anything on this week?
Unfortunately, most of our Heritage Week events have been hit by the COVID situation. It's one of the busiest weeks for us in the year. Normally,
I bet it is, yeah.
We're trying to do a few virtual online events, and I know that some of our branches do have some things lined up. It's all a little bit subject to change and all the social distancing and everything. If you keep an eye on the Birdwatch Ireland Facebook page, we're going to keep that
up. But you can actually go out and enjoy your heritage without a group. You can go outside your back door.
Absolutely.
A lot of people were doing it in the last couple of months, going for walks, taking in nature, breathing it in.
And we very much hope that people will do that. It's a great way to relax and unwind and sort of commune with nature again, I think. A perfect time to do that. And if you're looking to try and identify any birds that you see, we have a whole section of sort of a field guide to Ireland's birds at birdwatchireland.ie. So you'll find all the details there.
Okay. And you can visit our own website, rte.ie/Mooney, to get more information on National Heritage Week from the Heritage Council. And while you're there, you can have a look at a little video which was taken by our sound engineer today, Damien Schnell, and Damien has popped into the studio. Damien, yeah, show us this video or show it to Niall. People at home can follow what's going on, tell us all about it, and then maybe Niall, you might be able to answer Damien's question.
Sure.
I know what the question is already. Go on, Damien.
There's the guys. We've got magpie and seagull.
Oh, yes,
and
yes.
And they're sort of either palling around or...
Yeah.
Flying around together. I don't know what.
I'm not sure Pally it is actually looking at the video there. You filmed it very well, I must say.
Thank you. Well, they lend themselves well to it. But my question more so was we're got a lot of seagulls in our area since the lockdown. And it was sort of 2-3 months in before they came. So I figured they were hungry. Maybe they've been displaced and have to relocate to get.
Now, where exactly
other,
are you living, Damien?
Sources.
Not the exact address, but...
We're Balgriffin, so we're near the coast, mm-hmm. but not necessarily near enough the coast that we ever had gulls.
You're not far from Portmarnock.
We're not too far from Portmarnock.
Well,
or Howth.
It is normal enough for gulls to move inland, and as you said, you're not too far from the sea, so that's normal enough. The bird there, the particular type of gull, is a herring gull, which is the big one with the sort of silver-grey back that people will be familiar with. And I think that might be something in what you're saying, though. I think that a lot of these gulls, particularly in urban areas, have become quite used to scavenging for chips or going through bins or whatever. Yeah. And obviously during the height of the restrictions because of COVID-19, there wasn't so much human activity, nowhere near as much as there normally would be. I think a lot of that food would have disappeared almost overnight, and a lot of these gulls would have to forage elsewhere. And for the ones that have become very accustomed to scavenging and foraging in urban areas, they go for the easy food, absolutely. So it seems to be up on the roof there in your video, and it seems to be most likely using a high vantage point to look out for easy food. And of course, the magpie there, which is quite a bit smaller than the gull, and it's very clear in your video, the magpie would see it as a potential threat because, first of all, they're competing for the same food resources because that's what magpies do as well.
The wood pigeons are on that same roof, so... Regular visitors to that roof would be wood pigeons and the magpies.
No fiddlers, no?
No, not yet.
So the gull there is sort of nude into the mix.
Exactly.
And because it's bigger than all of those, it is quite intimidating. And on the show before, we've covered where herring gulls, this exact species, have learned to start killing and eating feral pigeons in Dublin City Centre, just off O'Connell Street. So they're very good at adapting to find new food sources. So for a bird like a magpie, this bird is a bit of a threat. Magpies are very intelligent birds. So when they see something new, they want to check it out. So the behaviour there in your video, when the gull takes off, the magpie immediately goes after it and then starts almost pecking at its tail and swooping towards it. That's a kind of behaviour we call mobbing. And what the magpie is trying to do is trying to scare and annoy the gull so much that it moves off. The magpie probably knows it can't do much to seriously injure it. It just wants to pester it so much that it goes somewhere else.
But have the gulls built a nest on your roof, Damien?
I don't know that. They're definitely close. I don't think they're necessarily on our roof, although they do go up there. There's about 25 gulls in our area that definitely have not been there since the lockdown, basically.
This summer in Birdwatch Ireland, we had originally planned to do quite a big survey of roof nesting gulls and getting people to send information into us. But obviously, because of COVID, that was really put on hold. We did get some data, but nothing like we had planned. So hopefully next year we'll be able to do more, all going well, because you just got a narrow window of time. It's just the summer months you can do this. That's when they're actually nesting. But certainly, we've had quite a lot of reports of gulls nesting on roofs and visiting urban areas. Part of that is, I think, because of the shortage of food elsewhere. I think part of it is, though, that people are spending more time at home, so they're noticing this in a way they wouldn't normally have. And it would be interesting to get data, if it's even possible, probably not, to see in the office spaces, particularly around big cities like Dublin and Cork, to see if more gulls have come to nest there or not. I think it's gone unnoticed.
Well, I see there's fewer people around the offices now, obviously, because most people are working from home, as you say. But that doesn't mean there's going to be more gulls, because there'll be less food.
Yes, so the gulls are looking for two things. Some of those gulls do seem to rely or have come to rely on humans for food. Some of the other gulls, though, that go into the city, they don't really exploit human food sources at all. They see the tall buildings.
Man-made
cliffs and islands, exactly. And obviously, gulls are very adept at finding food. The thing is, given the location of Dublin, there is still quite a lot of natural food around the coastline there. But of course, that leads to more competition among the birds. And people often think that, you know, herring gulls have increased in number. They're seeing more than ever. In fact, it is a species in crisis. It's on the red list, the highly endangered list in Ireland. The population has gone down by 90% in just 30 years. So it's not good news.
So Damien's gull and magpie are not friends.
No, we like to think that. I often blame lots of children's storybooks about this, that all the woodland creatures are friends and get on together. It's each creature for him or herself. Yeah, that's okay, what it is. Yeah.
Survival of the fittest. Yeah. It's like this studio now.
I've seen a lot of videos of them robbing crisps from shops and stuff like that as well.
Oh yeah, sure, they're taking everything.
They're taking
burgers out of people's hands. Yeah, they're only short of going in and ordering.
And part of the reason when you see them coming close to humans like that, taking food from the hand, it's because someone has actually fed this bird in the past, and that's not a good thing, because you've seen them yourself. They're quite intimidating. They're big birds. And it's good that they keep a healthy fear and respect for humans. I mean, it's one thing for them to scavenge food from bins or stuff that's left on the ground, but if they're coming and actually expecting people to feed them by hand, that's not a good thing.
Damien, thank you very much indeed. And you can see the video rte.ie/Mooney. Now, Niall, there's a story this week about swans turning pink.
Yes, this was a story that came from Westmeath. The county council there put a request out to people to ask them to stop feeding bread, especially mouldy bread, to the swans. It can be a problem, all right. What was happening was that these swans were developing pink feathers. It's something called flamingo swan disease, and it's caused by fungus in the bread. It causes an infection in the bird's feathers. And one of the things, the problems with bread is that very often people throw huge amounts of it into canals and rivers and ponds to feed the birds. And what happens is a lot of it just becomes waterlogged, sinks to the bottom, starts to rot. All sorts of bacteria and fungus and other nasty stuff starts to develop, and the water becomes very contaminated. And quite apart from that, bread isn't a very good source of food for swans and for other water birds anyway. It's full of empty calories. It's junk food, essentially. So, you know, there's lots of carbohydrates, but there's very little protein, not very much vitamins or minerals in it. So we always say much better to use leafy vegetables, actually. The leaves from the outside of spinach and lettuce work very well. Tops of carrots and celery, potato peelings work well. Much better than bread. The birds prefer it, but also you don't have this associated health risk.
Because that's what the swans are eating anyway. When you see a swan, is the term submarining when it turns upside down, you see its bottom in the air and it's got its neck? That's why it's got that long neck like a giraffe. The giraffe, if you see it on land, is reaching up to get its food. The swan is going down underwater to the bottom to grab the vegetation that's there beneath the surface.
That's exactly what they're doing. They're grazing along, and when the head is down under the water, they're using that bill, they're opening and closing it rapidly, and they're just sort of like mowing through all the pondweed and the algae that you find down the bottom there. And the thing is, there's only a certain depth of water they'll want to feed in, because they can only reach down as far as their necks will extend. They don't dive completely below the surface of the water.
No.
And so that means if the bread goes beyond that critical distance, it'll sink there, nothing will eat it, it'll just rot away. So it can be a problem, and that's what was seen in Westmeath, this issue with the swans having this pink colour in their feathers. And that may sound harmless enough, but what happens is the bacteria and the fungus then develop in the feathers and start to eat away at the feather material itself and cause the birds, in some cases, to even go flightless. It's that serious.
So what are you saying?
We're saying to people to please not feed bread of any kind to birds, particularly water birds. Much better if you're doing that to feed them leafy vegetables.
Leafy vegetables. Okay, you can email mooney@rte.ie or you can text us now about anything at all to 51551.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Now, regular listeners will be aware by now that this year we are celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. For a quarter of a century, we have been bringing you incredible wildlife stories, not just from Ireland, but from all over the world. Think of the Dawn Chorus. In that time, we have observed the most unusual birds and their nesting behaviour, broadcast live from seal releases in County Wexford, and been present at the arrival of the first sea eagles to be reintroduced to Ireland to mention just a few. But there is another side to wildlife crime here, a more sinister one, and that's wildlife crime. Crimes like the deliberate poisoning of birds of prey spring to mind. To combat this, a new organisation has been set up, and Terry Flanagan has more on this story. Terry.
Yes, Derek, as you know, our listeners love to hear the good news stories that occur, like the ones you mentioned, or who can forget the late Philip McCabe, broadcasting live, covered by bees, as he did so many times. But sadly, some people see wildlife in a different light, and their aim is not to enjoy it, but to destroy it. This can be so disheartening, not only to us, but to all those organisations like the National Parks and Wildlife Service and the wildlife organisations who do so much to help our flora and fauna. Anyway, recently, the Partnership for Action Against Wildlife Crime in Ireland has been set up. Wildlife crime here is currently underreported, and it is hoped that this organisation, or PAW Ireland, as it is known, will help to rectify this.
Now, who are PAW Ireland, the Partnership for Action Against Wildlife Crime?
Well, it includes a number of conservationists, land managers, welfare groups and state agencies. Now, during the week, I met up with the secretary of PAW Ireland, Paul Gallagher, and I began by asking him how serious wildlife crime is in Ireland.
The fact is, we don't actually know how bad wildlife crime is in Ireland, and that's very worrying.
Well, give me some examples of what you mean by wildlife crime.
Well, the most recent event that was publicised, the 23 buzzards that were killed down in Cork, that was an act of wildlife crime where poison bait was laid out, carbifen in the case of the poisoned buzzards, and it's a very toxic, you know, banned pesticide that was used.
And it was deliberately used to kill these birds?
Well, there wouldn't be really a good reason to use an illegal substance like that otherwise. The evidence would point towards some measure of it. But again, this is something that we just don't have information on because there's been no prosecutions on that case at all yet. So,
would you say then that wildlife crime, it's on the increase here in Ireland?
Well, the fact is we don't actually know because we don't have any data to show how bad the current situation is. We have nothing to work from. There hasn't been many prosecutions around wildlife crime either.
Does wildlife crime affect our reputation as a green country? People like to think of Ireland as being a green, nature-loving country.
Yes, it definitely has a big impact on that. If you look at the issues around the poisoning of white-tailed seagulls in Kerry when the programme initially happened back in 2007, it was gaining attention in Norway where the birds were originally from, and also in some cases nearly challenged the project itself if it was going to be worthwhile.
And I think it was similar, wasn't it, with the golden eagles?
Similar with the golden eagles, and in both cases now, as I understand, there hasn't been any significant events since that international attention was brought to it, but there has been significant events with the buzzards in Cork and other incidents in the last few months, even with buzzards being poisoned in Tipperary and Limerick, and also a guide dog, I think it was, poisoned in Wexford.
So this problem hasn't gone away?
It hasn't gone away. It's just that there's people reporting it more, and we hope with this wildlife app that the more eyes on the ground that we have, the more better able we are to see how bad the situation is.
Now, Paul mentioned a wildlife app, Terry.
Yes, one of the first things Paul are doing is creating a wildlife crime reporting app. It recently launched a GoFundMe campaign to raise money for the launch and running of this app, which will help minimise cruelty, torture, maiming and the killing of innocent wildlife.
Well, good for them.
I should say that I also met up with Garda Superintendent Martin Walker. Martin is passionate about wildlife and he is working closely with PAW Ireland. I was particularly interested in finding out the different types of crime he comes across and also how he feels this new app will help reduce it.
Yes, Terry, I am absolutely passionate about wildlife and conservation. It's part of our natural heritage and it's something that we should preserve for years and generations to come.
Yes, but you're doing it with a different hat on, so to speak, as a Garda.
That's correct. I'm a superintendent down in South Kildare and as such I have responsibility for an operation Bambi, which we ran a number of years ago and it was very, very successful and had a focus on combating the poaching of deer in West Wicklow and Leinster. the General Leinster area, and was very, very successful and culminated with a number of prosecutions against various individuals under the Wildlife Act. You will be familiar with the various poisonings, illegal trapping, baiting, shooting and hunting, and they're horrifyingly commonplace at this time, and it's up to us as individuals and as members of An Garda Síochána to curb that and put a controls in place and treat it robustly and bring those individuals responsible before the courts.
And prosecution numbers, are they up or down?
Prosecution numbers are down at the moment, and essentially the price of venison has dropped dramatically, and when you see a drop in price, you'll also see a drop in the number of poaching cases, because people are not making money and have no incentive then to go out and poach during the middle of the night.
And what about cases, say, of wildlife crime rather than just the poaching?
Well, wildlife crime is always there. It's omnipresent, and it takes various forms, whether it's bird crime, deer crime, hares, poaching hares, which is quite a recent phenomenon, and it's something that the IFA have been actively involved in. I've spoken to them on a number of occasions, because farmers they're finding that their farms are being invaded by individuals who are coming in without permission, trespassing on their land with a number of dogs, and they're literally forcing their way in and telling the farmers to go away and mind their own business on their own property, and that's an invasion that shouldn't be allowed to be facilitated.
Now, you're working with PAW Ireland, and to that end, you're about to launch a new app. Tell us a little bit about this app.
That is correct. PAW Ireland is launching a GoFundMe campaign, and it's essentially to fund an Irish wildlife crime reporting app to develop awareness, detection and reporting amongst members of the public. It's a free app, and they'll be able to download it on their smartphones at the end of the year.
And who would you like to download this app? Is it members of the public or conservation organisations or what?
It's focused at everybody. Anyone who has an active interest in wildlife crime, preventing and detecting it. And as I say, the three R's are there. That's to recognise, record and report incidents of crime, wildlife crime in Ireland. And that facility will be there on the map, and it'll be a contemporaneous reporting system as soon as they fill out the various little sections on the app and photographs and all of that, and it'll be given a GPS number as well. So it's a wonderful initiative, and I think it will be very, very effective.
Tell me one of the saddest cases you've come across.
Well, wildlife crime in relation to birds is very, very popular, because there is a black market there, an availability to sell birds which are illegally trapped. And we have a number of prosecutions presently before the court. But one case I remember distinctly, and it relates to an incident back in Carlow when I was the inspector there a number of years ago. And we raided an individual and his son, and we found somewhere in the region of 60 to 70 birds which had been illegally trapped using five or six illegal traps which were in his garden. And it was during a time of the year when food was scarce, and they were able to entice them in with call birds and with feed. And then they locked them up, and sometimes to put them into absolute darkness to take away their natural instinct, I suppose, for flight. And it controls them and placates them to some degree.
And I presume these would have been goldfinches.
Goldfinches, bullfinches, all of those.
Singing birds, all
of those type of birds. And there is a market there for them, and that's something that we have to be conscious of, people who are out buying birds. Normally, a young bird, it's before it fledges, it has a ring on it, and the ring is sealed, and that clearly identifies that the bird has been born in captivity. But some people then, they force a ring onto it, and there is a slight indentation or a split in it, and it's obvious to anyone who has handled them before, and that's a fair indicator that the birds have been illegally caught and snared and trapped.
And as for the future, PAW Ireland is now up and running, and the app will be very, very soon. Are you optimistic?
I am optimistic, Terry. I have to admit that. The introduction of the app and the formation of the PAW Ireland, I think it's a great initiative, a great robust challenge to that nefarious activity that is wildlife crime. I've been invited up, and I've attended a PAW meeting in Northern Ireland, both in relation to animals and also in fisheries, and I've seen how it works, and I've seen how efficient and how productive it can be. It's all about engagement, collegiality, partnership and developing an awareness, and that's what it's all about, and have the right reporting structures in place then for people to report these incidents and remain anonymous if they wish to do so. And we're really, another point I wanted to make was that this is not an anti-hunting initiative, because we're inviting the hunting confraternity, conservationists, land management and people who are involved in welfare and enforcement as well. We're all asking you to come forward and engage with us in this wonderful new forum.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Email mooney@rte.ie.
You may have seen on the news this week the story of Little White and Little Grey, two beluga whales, which have been taken from a watery circus theme park in China to a seawater sanctuary in Iceland. The first time these belugas have swam in seawater for over 10 years.
Little Grey and Little White were just calves when they were captured by Russian poachers and sold to this sea life centre in Shanghai. When ITV News filmed there last year, their handlers were preparing them to travel to their new home in Iceland. It's a journey that's taken them by land, air and sea, accompanied every step of the way by their care team, who kept them hydrated and kept them calm. This project is a world first, but the team behind it hope Little Grey and Little White won't be the last to benefit from it.
We have room for up to 8 more belugas here, so if we can improve the welfare of other belugas by either sharing information or bringing them here, that's where Little White and Little Grey are really the ambassadors for other belugas.
Sea Life Trust is a charity which brought the whales to the sanctuary. The sanctuary was funded by an organisation called Merlin Entertainments, and Rob Hicks is the Director of Marine Programmes and Engagement at Merlin Entertainments. Earlier, he spoke to us about their involvement.
Merlin Entertainments was very interested in this project, as we've always said that we don't believe that cetaceans, dolphins and whales should be kept in captivity for frivolous entertainment. And we actually, as an organisation, purchased a group of businesses over in Asia and Australia. And one of those was Shongfeng Ocean World in 2012, which had some belugas in. And since then, Merlin has been working really hard with the Sea Life Trust and Whale and Dolphin Conservation to look at how we could rehome these animals and what we could do to improve their welfare.
So the idea isn't necessarily to create a theme park in Iceland, is it?
No, of course not. No. The selection of Iceland has been purely driven for the requirements of Little White and Little Grey, the two beluga whales. We wouldn't have dreamt of putting a theme park in this beautiful, although isolated, island off the south coast of Iceland.
Can you describe the setup for me? What exactly have you done there in Klettsvik Bay?
So Klettsvik Bay is a beautiful bay, as you'll remember, which has got some very steep cliffs around three sides of it. So what we've created is a netted area which allows most of the bay for us to be protected, so Little White and Little Grey can be happily there, live happily there in the future. We've also created a series of what we're calling care pools, which allows us to bring the animals in so we can get closer to them, make sure they're doing really, really well, and just work with them as we need to. So what you could see, even if you look on Google Earth actually, you'd see the net line stretched across from one cliff to another, and then you'll be able to see the care pools as you look down upon them.
And how will you care for the whales when they're there? What exactly is going to happen?
So we've got a dedicated team of carers. So these are experts who know about cetaceans, in particular belugas, that will be caring for them. So the Little White and Little Grey went into the bay at the end of last week, and the team were there 24/7 whilst the animals were first settling in. And then gradually, as time progresses, we'll be spending less time with the animals. But what we'll be doing on a nearly hour by hour or minute by minute basis even, is observing them and making sure they're doing well. But then regularly, many times a day, we'll be working with them and feeding them and checking their well-being, taking some bloods occasionally and making sure everything's going very well for them.
Now, as I understand it, these two particular beluga whales were taken into captivity, was it 10 or 11 years ago? And over all that time, they would have been fed, hand-fed by humans. Are they going to be able to feed for themselves? This was one of the great concerns about Keiko when he was brought there before his reintroduction to the wild, that would he be able to feed himself? And people were claiming that, yes, he was feeding himself, and others were saying, no, he wasn't. So what's the situation with these two belugas? Will they be able to feed themselves?
Yeah, so Little White and Little Grey have been in human care for so long now. It's our understanding, and it's certainly the way that we're going to work this, that we'll be feeding the animals ourselves. We'll be maintaining their feed level, we'll be maintaining their health, we'll be maintaining their well-being. So during this time, we anticipate we'll be feeding them. We won't be releasing these animals to the wild, so they will remain in human care, just in an area that is huge and incredibly stimulating for Little White and Little Grey.
So there's no intention at any stage of letting these out into open ocean.
As we stand at the moment, no. They've been in captivity such a long time, considering how old they are. We don't believe that will happen. However, this is a world first. We're not sure how little white and little grey will adapt and change. So as we stand at the moment, no. But let's watch this and see what happens in the future.
Well, then presumably it's going to mean a huge boost to tourism in that area.
This has never been about tourism for us. This particular project has been about creating an amazing experience, an amazing facility that will allow little white and little grey, and then hopefully in the future more belugas, to come and spend the rest of their lives. So if there is some increase in tourism for the island, then that's fantastic for the island. But our main drive is obviously creating this new world's first beluga whale sanctuary.
So you don't intend at any stage to be chartering boats and bringing people out to get a close-up view of these whales when they're in the bay?
There is. That's certainly one of the things we're looking at, is allowing people at a distance to see little white and little grey kind of going through the water and then breathing. And so you will see them at a distance, but it is a distance thing. And yes, they will be allowed to do that, of course.
It's going to be pretty expensive, but I suppose you're going to need income to maintain your facilities there.
Yes, and we need donations. All the way through this, we've been very lucky in the way that the Sea Life Trust has been funded. So Merlin Entertainments has given the original funding to allow this facility to be built. But working with our partners, Well and Dolphin Conservation, they're helping us and the Sea Life Trust to fundraise to continue this project into the future.
Now, beluga whales, like any cetacean, would be used to endless miles of open ocean to swim and forage in. This is just another enclosure.
This is an enclosure that's 8 acres in size, and mixed with some spectacular underwater topography. So as you've been there, you've seen it. You've seen the cliffs and how they spring out of the water and dominate the landscape. Underwater is just as dynamic. So there's areas of rocks with heavy kelp growing and different fish and animals living in there. There's areas of pebbles with, again, different seaweeds growing and different animals living. And also there's a big area of sand with lots of flatfish and different, again, crabs and things that will create huge stimulation for little white and little grey going forward. So this is an amazing opportunity to increase the welfare of these two belugas, and we hope inspire other people to think about these sorts of facilities in the future.
Niall Hatch wants to ask you some questions. Niall.
Rob, you mentioned there about this beautiful sanctuary for the whales, and it does sound like a beluga whale paradise. How does that compare to the facilities they've been living in up to now? What's their experience been?
So the facility in China was built many years ago, but it was built as a facility to entertain the public. And as such, you can imagine, you know, the staging and then the views that people would have had of the animals. So that's how it would have been when they were in China. And then as we've taken it on, we've changed some elements to increase their welfare. But the thing we are really excited about is how little white and little grey are starting to interact with other animals in the bay. So they went in last week. And then I think the day after, a puffin landed in their care pools, which little white and little grey hadn't seen a wild bird for 10 years plus. They were quite surprised by this. And then this bird was obviously quite surprised by them and swam off and then flew off at a rate of knots. But little white and little grey were quite interested and followed the bird around for a little bit, and then it flew off. They just saw it disappear. So the interaction they're going to get in the bay is spectacular, and can't wait to see what happens next. Two belugas do not a sanctuary make, and we are hoping to find more belugas that can come on this journey and come to Clettsfit Bay. And then we're really hoping that other people will take on this idea and concept of a sanctuary and build sanctuaries for other cetaceans that are currently in human care.
Rob, thank you very much indeed.
Gentlemen, thank you.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Hello, Wendy.
Good to talk to you about your book, The Language of Butterflies. Now, the first thing that strikes me from your book is that you really love butterflies.
Well, you know, when I started this book, I didn't know I loved butterflies. It's a new phenomenon because I think loving butterflies has a lot to do with how much you know about them. The more you know about them, the further down the rabbit hole you go, as I said in my book.
Well, you certainly expressed your love of them very much in the book, and it comes across very clearly from your pages. Now, you've actually gone through the scientific story of butterflies. Now, when children go to school nowadays, one of the first things they learn when they're very small is about the life cycle of the butterfly, how the lovely butterfly lays the eggs, they hatch out into caterpillars, they eat until they burst, they pupate, and finally they become a lovely butterfly. But this was never known in the world at all until the late 1600s. And it was a woman, Maria Merian, who actually discovered all this. And she started her scientific work in Germany at the age of 13. Tell us about her.
Yes, Maria Sibylla Merian is one of my favorite characters in the book. She was born in the midst of the 1600s when women were still being burned as witches, over on your side of the Atlantic, as well as here in New England on my side of the Atlantic. So it was the world was a dangerous place for women in those days, and women didn't have very much freedom. They really weren't allowed to do very many things. Maria was the daughter of a publisher, and in those days, to be a publisher meant that everything was done in the same house. The writing was done, the art was created, the printing was done, and finally the book itself was produced. And Maria, from the age of 5, was part of this last stage. She was asked to use her watercolors to fill in the line drawings that other artists had made. So she was very involved with publishing. The advantage of this to her was that smart, important, intellectual people came to her house to talk to her dad. Well, Maria obviously wasn't going to be part of that group, but of course, as a child, she could sit around on the fringes and listen to all this exciting talk. On the other hand, Maria wasn't allowed to do much, so mostly when she wasn't helping her dad out working in his publishing house, she was allowed to do things like go out into her mother's garden. She'd heard people talking about insects, because insects were very popular in those days, and she started looking at the insects on the plants in her mother's garden, and she began to discover that caterpillars were much more interesting than anyone had ever realized. She probably had a small, crude microscope, not sophisticated like what we have today, but enough so that she could look at the tiny details of these caterpillars and see the beautiful colors and the beautiful structures that the caterpillars have. She also noticed that the caterpillars used the same leaves all the time. They didn't just eat any plant randomly, they ate specific plants. And then she learned that they made specific chrysalises. And then she learned that out of these chrysalises emerged specific butterflies. This is common knowledge to us today, but believe it or not, people in the middle of the 1600s had no idea there was this kind of order in nature. Maria began drawing this as she was trained to do, and over the next 20 years, she painted art that included pictures, detailed pictures of caterpillars, detailed pictures of the leaf damage they did, detailed pictures of their chrysalises, and ultimately, detailed pictures of the beautiful butterflies that emerged. At about the age of 32, she decided to make her own book. She kind of had to do this because she wasn't allowed to publish any kind of scientific research since she was female. So she said, fine, I'll just make my own book. And she made her own book of the caterpillars, leaf damage, chrysalises, and butterflies of Europe. And lo and behold, it became an instant bestseller all over Europe. She had inadvertently created the science of ecology.
A wonderful woman indeed. Now, butterflies are actually a very ancient group, we can gather this, but getting fossils of things like insects with wings is nearly impossible. The fossilisation process destroys all that. But there is actually a fossil from 34 million years ago, and it was found by another intelligent woman, an American woman this time, Charlotte Hill, who found this in the 1880s in Colorado. More women power for you. Tell us about Charlotte and how she managed to find a fossil with the wings intact.
Yeah, Charlotte Copen Hill is another woman whose adult life began at the age of 13. She got married, and her husband took her away from civilization up into the Colorado Mountains, which are very steep and very rugged and very isolated. There she had a number of children in a homestead, which basically was a tiny little cabin. And it was her job to take care of the homestead, to feed her children, to work in her own garden, to raise food for the children. But in her spare time, she began to dig in the area around there. Without realizing it, the homestead had been built on top of an ancient lake from 34 million years ago. They lived on top of sediments that had formed over the course of thousands of years. And Charlotte, and probably her kids too, started digging in this area and came up with fossil after fossil after fossil of these old animals from 34 million years ago. I'm sure they were quite stunned. They were fascinated. And some of these insects that they found, and other animals as well, still existed in the world that Charlotte lived in, but many of them didn't. So the mystery of where these animals came from and why some of them looked so odd and unusual struck her. At the same time, she was out in Colorado, but on the East Coast, paleontology was coming into its own. Professors from places like Harvard and Yale were starting to get really interested in ancient fossils. They heard about the fossils that were out in Colorado and went out, and they visited Charlotte Copen Hill and looked at the fossils that she had, and they hired her to be a fossil collector for them. Ultimately, Charlotte and or her kids, nobody knows who really dug up this amazing butterfly, but it turns out to be the number one butterfly at Harvard University, but almost really the number one butterfly fossil in the entire world because it's very complete. There's only a tiny, tiny little bit of a tail missing on one side of it. You know, butterflies are really fragile, and they don't really preserve as fossils very well. We don't really know why this particular insect preserved so well. Maybe ash fell on top of it. Maybe it died floating on the pond, and ash fell on top of it and pushed it down to the bottom, and nothing really moved, nothing stirred there. We don't know the exact conditions of why this butterfly fossil preserved as well as it did. But I can tell you, I went to Harvard and visited with the fossil, and it really is fascinating to look at.
Sure it is, and we must look at it eventually when we can all travel again. Now, butterflies generally overwinter in this part of the world at any rate, as a chrysalis, as a cocoon, but the one or two of them, like the brown hair streak, overwinters as an egg, and you mentioned in your book one or two that overwinter as caterpillars, as larvae. But there's also a group that are migratory butterflies. They don't overwinter here at all. They're migratory. They come from warmer places. And the one that we know here in Europe, and indeed in other parts of the world, is the painted lady. So painted ladies will arrive here in Ireland, perhaps beginning of July, when they've moved up from southern Europe. But you have a great scale, a great story about the painted ladies at terribly high heights altogether. Tell us about those.
The thing about the painted ladies, and we don't have any stories like this in the United States, the painted ladies come from all over the north. As you mentioned, they'll be in Ireland, they'll be in Asia. They make their way all the way up north and arrive there in the middle of the summer. And then eventually painted ladies begin their incredible migration all the way back to where it will be warm for the winter time, which often, but not always, is the Sahel region of Africa. When they start flying, they fly at phenomenal heights. I don't think anyone realized quite how high they were, but a team of mountain climbers was all the way up in the Himalayas at 22,000 feet, and they were exhausted. There's a book about this that I quote in the book, in my own book, They were exhausted, having climbed so high and having endured many not very good weather conditions, standing on this ridgeline, and suddenly the author of this book looked up and saw scores and scores and scores of painted ladies flying high over his head at 22,000 feet. It's really phenomenal that they could get up there, because as those who have climbed to 22,000 feet, which would not be me, by the way, know there's not a lot of oxygen up there. How did they get up there? But somehow they're riding the winds that took them all the way up to the top of the Himalaya Mountains, and these wind currents had carried them at 22,000 feet over the saddle of the mountains, and he saw them there. It was, for him, a really glorious and heartening sight, and made him feel as though he could finish his climb.
Yeah, it gave him heart, didn't it? You mentioned the monarchs there. We occasionally get monarchs in Ireland, but they come up from the Canary Islands. There's a colony, as you know, there, which are blown up occasionally on southern winds. Now, the poor devils are on a hiding to nothing because we don't have milkweeds growing here. But you have a lot of your book, as you say, dedicated to telling us the story of the monarchs that are flying from North America all the way streaming down as far as a couple of just valleys in Mexico, and you describe in great detail how they change their sterile going down so they can all land on top of each other without being stimulated or anything, and then the temperature changes their ability to reproduce and they come back again. An amazing story. And we only found all this recently. We could put a man on the moon and we didn't know where the monarch butterfly was going, and you went to that place in Mexico and saw them. It must have been super.
It was super. I didn't expect it to be super because I'd already been researching this book for several years, and I'd gone to several places where west of the Rocky Mountains on our continent, there are some monarchs that fly and overwinter to California. Who doesn't want to spend the winter in California, by the way? So it's a good idea. So I thought I'd seen everything. But for the last section of my book, my husband and I decided that we would go to see the monarchs that had made it all the way to Mexico. As we were walking up, the Mexican towns and villages that sponsor these monarchs, by the way, are really well organized these days. So you get there, it's about a three-hour drive out of Mexico City. When you get there, you're met by guides and you're met by greeters who will help and show you around. And then people walk you up the mountain to see the monarchs. We started walking up at around 10 o'clock in the morning, which, as I mentioned in my book, is about when butterflies like to get up. So we started walking up from 11,000 to 12,000 feet, which was very high for me. I live at sea level. So I wasn't walking very quickly because I didn't think there was enough air even there. And as I was slowly making my way up this very lovely trail, down came these streams and streams and streams of rivers of monarchs in the sunlight. I think they were going down to go for a water resource because it was warmish for that time of year, and the sun was out and shining, and it really was one of the most glorious wildlife experiences I've ever had.
It's a great book, Wendy. It's a great read. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It's written by Wendy Williams. And I recommend it to everybody. It was great speaking with you. Thank you so much, Wendy. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm always happy to talk to you. It was fun talking to you, and I love all the things that you pulled out of the book.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Indeed, it is a terrific book. A really, really good read, as Aina had said. I'm thinking of those butterflies and that migration they make. Just think of where Wendy is. I can't get over the technology nowadays. I mean, she's sitting in her home in New England. If you were to leave Dublin, think of that arc bending down to the northeast of America, over 3,000 miles, whatever that is in kilometres, and there she is sitting in her living room having a chat with us. Anyway, Niall, didn't you some time ago try to mark off all of the butterflies found in Ireland?
I did, and I did it successfully. It was a couple of years ago, and I wanted to see all 34 of the regularly occurring Irish butterfly species. You know, the ones that are here you'd expect to see that aren't, you know, rare vagrants or something like that. So there's 34 of them across Ireland, and I'm glad to say I managed it within the year.
Did you?
I did. It was great fun. Takes you to all sorts of places. You have to go to the Burren, not once, but twice, because there's different butterfly species emerge at different times. You have to be lucky with some of the migrants. So one of the trickiest ones for me that year was the clouded yellow, because sometimes they arrive in Ireland in big numbers, some there are hardly any. that year wasn't particularly good for them, but I did manage to find one. And some are tricky, like the purple hair streak. This is the time of year now when you look for those. It's one of our latest emerging butterflies. They're always in oak trees, but they're very, very high. So you really have to be very patient to try to find that.
Are you familiar with Tom Lehrer?
From the Elements.
The Elements song, yeah. You know. He wrote the song about the periodic table of elements.
You're going to sing it for us?
No, but I was going to ask you, could you name all the butterflies found in our... could you sing it, Niall, more importantly?
I could, but it would be very boring radio, so...
Not at all. Anyway, thank you very much indeed, Niall. Thanks also on sound today to Damien Chanel, who was also a guest on studio, should I say. Our researcher is John Bell O'Reilly, and our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. We're not here next Sunday afternoon, but we will be back next Monday evening at 10 p.m. with a special programme about Waterways Ireland. Tomorrow evening, you can find a second chance to hear a documentary about crows. Very interesting programme right here from the Mooney Goes Wild Archive at 10 p.m. Until tomorrow then, bye!
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.